Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Final segment of the show, and it's always a great pleasure to bring back not a two-time but a three-time guest, Laura Vandekam, based out of Pennsylvania. How are you today, Laura?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
You betcha. Well, let me give a brief introduction. Laura is a prolific freelance writer with career and specialty topic columns often featured in USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, Reader's Digest, and online The Huffington Post and Scientific American venues. A Princeton graduate who also studied abroad, Laura has a portfolio of newsroom, reporting, and freelance experiences, and was a 2006 recipient of a year-long journalism fellowship from the Phillips Foundation to study the political changes in the courts. A resident of New York City at the time, Laura joined us back in 2008, and we were just beginning radio, by the way, with her first solo book that had come out entitled Grind Hopping, Build a Rewarding Career Without Paying Your Dues. We then caught up with her mid-2010, expanding her journalism and publishing credentials, and as a mother then of two young boys, both under age three, with a second book called 168 Hours, You Have More Time Than You Think. And it helped readers rethink that 24/7 mantra of this day and age and consider getting a time makeover, as she called it, to achieve a more balanced life and reach their personal goals. So, you know, here we are, no surprise, catching her a third time, having now with her husband, who is a management consultant, and three young children, having moved to Pennsylvania. So our topic is her newly released book, as in just 2 days ago, called All the Money in the World, What the Happiest People Know About Getting and Spending Money. So congratulations, three times author, three times mom, right?
Exactly. Books and babies lining up.
Now, there you go. Well, I have to suggest, too, that the timing of all three of these books, obviously Grind Hopping, was in a time when the whole idea of creating your own career and not getting stuck in a rut one way or another was so hot. 168 hours, I can imagine, for a mom with two young ones, as well as all the things you balance on your plate. That made sense. And then, of course, today and age, you know, all the money in the world and this link to happiness, right? Because so many people, I think, perhaps maybe are in a state of confusion with that one.
It's true. I mean, it's no secret the economy has been on a bit of a roller coaster the past few years. We seem, let's hope, to be coming out of the real dark days of this recession. But even so, as we're slowly getting things back together, many people have sort of a different mindset about money. We'd like to use money in more meaningful ways and use it as a tool to help build the lives we want.
Indeed. Now, Laura, I know both of your first two books, and I, of course, had the pleasure of getting a sneak peek and read your new book. This isn't just Laura's ruminating and cutting across previous columns that she's written, but rather you continue to do research and interviews and mine data from a variety of sources, don't you?
I certainly try to. There's a lot of self-help books on the market, and I think what I could hopefully offer readers a little differently is that I love mining data sources. I like looking at things like the Consumer Expenditure Survey, data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics on what different professions earn, data from the Federal Reserve about how people in different income brackets save their money, things like that. Because it's one thing to just talk about how you view things. I think it's more fun to have opinions that are informed by numbers that are out there. So that's what I try and offer people.
So on this journey that you've been on to prepare to write this book, and by the way, was this more of a topic you always wanted to address, or did the topic kind of come to you because of a variety of circumstances?
It more came to me from a variety of circumstances. I mean, I have always been interested in money. Who isn't, really? We all think about money whether we want to or not. But this came out of writing 168 Hours, which was about how we spend our time.
Oh, yeah.
And time and money are two incredibly related variables, because you can spend time to save money. You can also spend money to save time. So these two variables tend to be moving on different axes. And I wanted to see, well, how can we optimize each of them? How can we use money in the best way possible, just in the same way we're trying to use time in the best way possible? There are things that have some intriguing parallels and intriguing differences in terms of both time and money being things we never seem to have enough of. On the other hand, time is an absolutely limited resource. None of us has more than 168 hours a week, whereas money is not necessarily as limited. That people have a wider variety of incomes, wider variety of wealth levels, and a wide variety of what they want to do with their money. So I like to explore that difference in this book as well.
So, and I couldn't agree with you more, by the way. It's not just what they want to do with their money, but the expectations that come with that, or maybe even the societal pushes or the marketing traps, whatever we want to call it, that we have to kind of hold at bay to stay true to who we are, of course, in the mix. So share with us some of the ahas, or the things that really caught you off guard when you started conducting your interviews or doing your research and mining data for your book.
Sure. Well, one of the interesting things readers might want to know is that in the process of writing this book, I was in the process of moving from New York to Pennsylvania, and for the first time in my life, I became a homeowner. So I bought a house in the course of all this, and of course, buying a house is one of the biggest financial decisions people ever make. And I certainly spent a lot of time thinking about it, because if you look all over the web and talk to different financial advisors, there's certain ranges of what people think is normal to spend on a house. And certainly many budget calculators say you can spend, a third of your income on housing. The issue is that this doesn't seem to change based on what people are earning. So even right. People who have very high incomes are still thinking, oh, well, I should spend a third of my income on housing. And if you think about it, that's kind of ridiculous. You don't have to, right? You could spend a lot less, still get a decent house, and then have a lot of extra money for all kinds of other things that could, really create a fun life. So things like travel, being able to give generously to charity, hobbies you may have, maybe not even having to work as hard if you want to take time off from work, for instance. All those things are choices you can make by spending less on housing, because housing just is such a big chunk of what most Americans spend their money on. And the numbers I like to use for people is that the difference between spending 33% of your income on housing and 25% is 8% to spend on other things. That can buy a lot of happiness if you spend it on the right stuff.
Well, the other piece of it is sometimes the people buy the house and do that 33% without realizing we have things now called upkeep. Mm-hmm. And also for those of us that happen to believe that stuff breeds on itself, that actually the more space you have, the more stuff you fill it up with. And do you really need all that stuff when you step back?
I think it's a good question. I can't say that I wound up buying a small house, or at least it doesn't feel very small to me coming from New York City. But it has been an interesting question to ponder in terms of why we bring certain things into our lives, what of those things makes us happy and what do not. In the course of writing this book, I, for instance, have basically stopped shopping for clothes. I realized I just don't enjoy it. There's no point. I'll buy what I absolutely have to have to look decent if I step outside my home office, but I don't get much pleasure out of it, whereas I do get a lot of pleasure out of spending my money on other things.
Well, and particularly for any of us that are enjoying the opportunity to raise our children, this goes back to the whole issue of time as well, or opportunity with time. At the end of the day, that's really what the kids want, is our time and our attention. And particularly how many times we buy the wonderful Christmas gift, wrap it up, and they actually like playing with the box more than what you put in the box.
That certainly can be true. Sometimes kids may want something expensive for a certain reason, but many times they don't. Many times they want something fun, and so fun can be found at all different price points.
Yeah, that's true. So your book, Laura, obviously we got a sense of what motivated you to do this. Now, you look at both the getting part of the equation as well as the spending part of the equation, don't you?
I do. I think that a lot of personal finance literature tends to focus on the spending part of the equation because that's perceived as the side that people have the most control over, at least in the short run, right? That your income is harder to change. But I think that that's not 100% true anymore. I found a statistic the other day that the average worker is now changing jobs every 4 years. So that means that every 4 years you have an opportunity to rethink the income side of the equation in terms of what you can negotiate, what kind of employer you'll be looking for, and how that all adds up. Certainly people can look at how many members of the household are in the labor force and for how many hours a week. That's a variable that we can control. And even things like having other sidelines. You know, in this day and age, when we think about a second job, it often sounds a little dreary, like reporting to another work site after a long day at the first. And certainly that wouldn't do much for you except make you exhausted. But in this economy, there's a lot of other ways to make money that may tap into a more creative side, something a little different, more flexible. Lots of people, you know, starting online businesses as another sort of income stream, or selling things on Etsy even, or freelancing. And all of this can be more enjoyable, things you might even be doing for fun, and then if you can get paid for them, that's really quite a windfall. So I tell people, you know, you can look at the income side of the equation as well, and really, honestly, if you want to make a big change in your financial life, that's probably where you should look, because you know, there's always a limit to how much you can cut. You can't save more at the grocery store than you're actually spending at the grocery store.
Right.
Whereas, at least in theory, there's no limit to how much you can earn.
Well, what I think is kind of interesting, of course, is that this is just the nature of any of us that write or think about big thoughts like you do, is the fact now you're taking us back to that very first book you wrote called Grind Hopping, you know, Build a Rewarding Career Without Paying Your Dues. And I recall your real message to people wasn't necessarily that you're going to leapfrog and not do the jobs that you're tasked to do or enjoy if you choose to be within an organization, but there's every possibility to build something off to the side that maybe in time you could transition to full time. But I think the other point you just made was this idea that you can play on your multiple strengths and equate to this other goal of your book, which is to talk about money in the context of happiness.
Yes, because, I mean, happiness stems from how we earn our money and not just how we spend our money. If you're earning your money in a way that also brings you joy, it's like a double happiness whammy because, you know, you have to have money to survive, but if you can get it in a way that's enjoyable, that's great.
That's great. In fact, the statistic that caught my eye, you quoted the fact that this is 2009 data that 26% of people that are employed are actually in the 1099 mindset, not the W-2 mindset. In other words, freelancers, of course, yourself included, and now myself in the same situation.
Yes, there's about a quarter of the workforce considers themselves free agents, which some of those people probably do have normal jobs as well, but that also means that they're not thinking of themselves as being tied long-term to any particular organization, and that they are thinking of their career from the perspective of them designing it long-term, and not necessarily, hitching their fortunes to any particular organization.
Yeah, that's right. So in the getting part of your book, of course, you even called it Don't Scrimp More, Make More. And then you also, though, dedicated a good chunk of time on really rethinking retirement. And I don't even know if that's a word that you or my generation will gravitate towards as much as those who preceded us.
Probably not, because the way the workforce exists is just changing. I mean, the idea that you would get a job at age 25 and hold it till age 65 is just not in the mindset of most young people these days. They just cannot even conceive of that happening. They assume that whatever they're doing at age 65 has pretty much no relation to what they're doing at age 25. So once you have that in mind, then 65 is not a particular magical age, right? There may be other times in your life that you wish to work less. I mean, for instance, if you have small kids, maybe that's a time that you'd like to not work quite as intensely. But then during other times in your life, maybe when the kids are a little older or before they come, those are times that you can work more intensely. So which stage you'll be in at age 62 or 65 is entirely up to you.
Or even if that number is a fictitious number, since so many more people are choosing with longevity being on our mindset, not the word aging, but rather longevity, you know, kind of flip that coin, is this idea of mental, social, emotional, and physical vitality tied to how we spend our time during our day, which if we choose to have a portion of it being putting more coins in the piggy bank, you know, all the more power to you.
And there are a lot of reasons to continue putting the coins in the piggy bank. I mean, it's no secret that most people don't have huge amounts of money saved up for retirement, so that's one problem right there. Living off Social Security and a small amount of savings is not going to give you necessarily a very great life, not the kind of life people are hoping for when they think of retirement. But if you look at it this way, I mean, people say you can pull out 4% of your assets per year in retirement to live on. So if you look at it from the different direction, then every $10,000 you can make is $250,000 you don't have to have in the bank. Mm-hmm. So if you do have a part-time job, for instance, in your golden years that you're earning, you know, $20,000 a year doing, you know, you add that to what savings you have into Social Security, you can actually start to live a more enjoyable lifestyle where you can pursue your hobbies, maybe travel a little bit during the time you're not working and things like that.
Yeah, very put. The your book, of course, I know it's going to be like your first two. It's going to prompt people to take pause and actually twist the definitions around they might have been locked into, just like in 168 hours. You know, instead of saying 24/7, well, let's look at the whole packet, which is 168 hours. So I wanted to sensitize our listeners and appreciate them. They get a chance to read your new book, Laura, that looking at the spending side of the equation, that there's a lot of things we probably want to take a look at just setting aside. In other words, that are not the same cultural trap of the past. You know, one chapter, the big American dream, right?
Yes, that's the chapter I talk about, what I was mentioning earlier with housing. I write a chapter called Laughing at the Joneses, which points out that we have a tendency to spend more on positional goods. And those are goods that other people can see and compare. Who knows if your marriage is better than anyone else's? And who knows if your potluck dinner with friends is more enjoyable than someone else's picnic, right? We cannot mm-hmm. compare these things. But I can definitely tell if you spent more on your house than I did, right? I can tell if your car is of more luxurious make than mine is. And so the tendency is always to spend more on these goods that are easily compared, because humans are social animals, and we really do derive a lot of our sort of life status from where we land in the heap. But of course, that's still a choice. You know, we are not necessarily tied to how we lived as apes, even if that is the way our brains evolved. We can choose whether we do that, and we can focus on things that aren't as easily compared and spend our money on those things, because those do tend to be the things that make us happier. So, you know, dinner out with friends, or travel, or hobbies, or volunteering, doing things with your kids. These are all ways to buy happiness, ways we can use our money to buy happiness that we don't necessarily get used to in the same way that we get used to a house and get used to a car.
Well, in fact, I wanted to go with that, this idea of putting the challenge out there of the one car challenge, let alone those of us that have teens and had the means to provide three cars to the family. The idea of getting back to one car, not only are you dealing with, you know, saving on fuel and insurance costs and repairability and the like, but, oh, by the way, you're opening up the possibility for actual conversation when you're traveling together.
It's true. We're a two-car family. I'll put that out there. When we moved to the suburbs, we wound up buying two cars. But we did think about it for a while. Like, could we make life work with one car? And I think it's just an interesting question to ponder, because you start thinking, well, why do we do certain things? Do we need a car to drive to the store? Well, why are we going to the store? Do we actually need something? Or are we going just because we're bored and there's nice roads leading us there and we have time free this afternoon and there's wonderful things in the store? These are all important questions. You know, do I know my neighbors? That's another part of this, because people say, well, I need a car in emergencies. Well, in the past, when not everyone had two cars, you probably got to know your neighbors so that if they had a car at the time, you know, they could bring you somewhere. Whereas now, you know, many people don't actually know their neighbors very well and don't feel like they could go over and bang on the door and say, listen, I have to get to the doctor's office now, and have someone take them. So it's something just to ponder, of what we have changed about our lives by coming up with a situation where every adult has their own means of transportation.
Well, I was going to go another direction. Do I ever sit here? In fact, I had this happen to me, as I had a kitchen appliance break right before a major dinner event that I'm expecting guests. And so there was a side of me that says, oh, I can run to the local Home Depot and pick up another one. And then I said, wait a minute, I'll just go next door and borrow Diane's. And when I headed out the door to do that, my kids were like, are you crazy? You're going to go borrow it from a neighbor? And I'm thinking, oh, dear, what have I missed here in instructing them of the possibility?
Go to borrow a cup of sugar, I guess that's just something that was part of our communities perhaps in the past and is less so now. And we've created a world where we do value our freedom and our autonomy quite a bit, and part of that is having your own means of transportation. But I think people should think about at least that we give something up at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well put. Well, Laura, so your book just came out 2 days ago, and though I know there's a few that have snuck out and you've shared copies with others, what's been the reaction so far?
Well, a lot of people are telling me that they really enjoy thinking about money this way. I know that personal finance literature tends to be fairly dreary.
And frightening, too.
Dreary and frightening when you read through a lot of it. I mean, talking about how you need to cut all these coupons and you need to do stuff like drying your clothes on a clothesline to apparently save, you know, $40 a year on your dryer bill. This just gets to be a little tedious, a little dry, a little like, geez, will I ever have any enjoyment in my life? I try to view money from more of a philosophical perspective. There are no budgets in this book. There's nothing about how to get out of debt. If you're looking for that, go buy something else. But if you are looking about how to think of money in a different way, how to use money as a tool to build the life you want, then I hope that this book can help you with that.
Very good. And so with that, thank you so very much, Laura Vanderkam. Our listeners, you can learn more about Laura's work at www.lauravanderkam.com. And the book we've been speaking about, her third, congratulations again, is All the Money in the World, What the Happiest People Know About Getting and Spending Money. So with that, Laura, we'll catch you probably 2 years from now. I don't know if that's going to mean a fourth child or not in the mix, but all the best to you, and thanks again for contributing here on Circles of Change.
Thank you so much.
You bet.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.